I think with the Trump administration, you see totally different. We had a downed airman, and he said, hey, I don't care what it takes, go get our guy. And they did that. So morale is huge. And it just makes you want to join the military. It makes you want to go fight. And not only that, it also put the U.S. military on the map for everybody else to see, including our adversaries. So now they know, it's just like, okay, well, this new guy's in the White House, it's not playing any games anymore. So yeah, it's great show of American power.
Today we're joined by Eric Leinhardt, a decorated former U.S. Air Force combat controller and founder of the First Dare Foundation, part of one of the military's most elite and least known special operations forces. Eric operated on the front lines, coordinating complex air missions in the most dangerous environments, and earning 2 Bronze Stars, one with valor, for his actions in a 4-hour firefight in Afghanistan. In this conversation, he takes us inside the high-stakes world of rescue operations and battlefield coordination, reflects on the recent rescue mission in Iran, shares what it takes to stay calm under extreme pressure, and reflects on leadership resilience and his mission today supporting others through his foundation. This is Bay Area Innovators, and I'm your host, Steve Ispas. Eric, welcome to Bay Area Innovators.
Yeah, it's a pleasure being here. Thank you so much for making the time.
Yes, well, great to have you here in Austin, Texas. We welcome you to our program here. So I want to start with you explaining to our audience and to myself, what is a United States Air Force combat controller? I know it's a special operations unit, but just give us a bit more detail on that.
Yeah, it's a great question to start with, for sure. A lot of people don't know who we are, they know that we exist. So Air Force Combat Controllers have been around since 1953. And our bread and butter, especially during the Afghan War, was close air support. Now, there's other units in the Army, the Navy, they all have some type of close air support personnel or unit that does it, but not like an Air Force Combat Controller. Because we are in the Air Force, we go through a 2-year training program, just as the Navy SEALs, the Green Berets, the Marine Raiders. And it's tough, man. We do a lot of what we got to be able to infill and exfill with any military force out there. We only work with special operations. So those 3 branches that I've mentioned, the Green Berets, SEALs, and Raiders, and then coalition soft. So when we go to war, what happens is we're a team guy. If we're either manning a gun or breaching or, you know, part of the stack. But then when a firefight kicks off, our job is to get on our radio and start directing close air support, whether it's guns, rockets, bombs. And even if an individual gets hurt, then our job is to call in the medevac and we get our guys out of there. Our pipeline is 2 years, like I said. I think our attrition rate when I was going through was 87%. So out of the 20 guys that I went through, only 4 of us made it. And you know, it's your first year is the toughest. So the first year, they kind of make sure that you can make it. It's a lot of PT, a lot of water confidence, and yeah, it's tough. And then after that, you go to airborne school, survival school, air traffic control school, which is one of the hardest because not only are you doing PT and everything else that you need to stay within the program, but then the mental aspect of air traffic control is tremendous. And then the last thing you go through is combat control school. Then your second year, you go to HALO school, which is military free fall. You go to combat dive school. And then you also learn all the weaponry that you have in the Department of Defense or Department of War now. And yeah, it's a special skills training. They put it all together right before you go to your team. So a lot of people haven't heard of us, but if people look up John Chapman, he's the epitome of a combat controller. He was awarded a Medal of Honor. And it was the first Medal of Honor ever recorded. He, in fact, saved the members of SEAL Team 6 and a couple other service member rangers and a couple of aviators on Roberts Ridge. A lot of people may be familiar with that.
So it's a special force unit that's similar to the Navy SEALs and the Green Berets on the same kind of level, but within the Air Force.
Yes. You take a Green Beret and a Navy SEAL, you smash them together and you get a combat controller. And what makes this, like I said, obviously I'm biased to it because I was one, but we have the air piece, right? We coordinate anything that flies. So that's what makes us even more special. And then there's only about 300 to 350 of us per year. So that's how tough this program is. And I think that's why maybe a lot of people haven't heard of us.
When we talk about the operations, the rescue operations from deep inside enemy lines, like the recent one in Iran that we'll be talking about, what would you say that makes such an operation so complex to make it successful?
Well, there's a couple different factors. You take a look at the recent one where we extracted the WISO, or the weapons system operator, from the F-15 that crashed, or that was shot down. Iran, people forget that Iran, prior to us crushing them, they were the seventh largest, if I'm not mistaken, military in the world. So it wasn't a simple operation like if it would have happened in Afghanistan, where Afghanistan was just a bunch of different militias and tribes that were fighting us, right? Iran had a strong military. And for this particular mission, you got to look at the terrain, the weather. And obviously, you heard that the Iranian government had put a bounty on this pilot. So not only you had the military, or the decentralized military now at that point, looking for this guy, but you know, the Iranians, people were just looking for him. And depending on what propaganda they had received about the Americans, I mean, they were probably going to hurt him pretty bad if they got their hands on him. So you have civilians now looking for him, you have a decentralized military looking for him, and plus whatever military elements are out there. So obviously the plane got shot down with some type of either a manpad or some type of surface to air missile or rocket. And you know, so it wasn't safe. It wasn't a simple extraction, right? I mean, a lot of coordination had to happen, and I think that's why it took 48 hours to get this pilot.
Right, and of course we have the story on our front page this week, the rescue operation. Now, it's been said that there's over 155 aircraft that were involved in the rescue. Can you talk a bit about that? Like, how does one even organize it, or how do you manage, you know, that kind of operation? It sounds crazy.
Yeah, no, I believe it. I mean, let's just say when the pilot went down, when they both ejected, then most of the time American aircraft travel in at least pairs, right? So when one got shot down, the other one, you know, took note of their location, called it back to the rear where this, you know, where the ejection happened, where it went down, looking for parachutes in the air. But then when they started looking for this pilot, the second one, especially, you had surveillance, I'm sure, not only our satellites, but you had drones up there, you had refueling aircraft, you had possible helicopters ready to go, maybe flying a ring route or some type of patrol route where it was safe for them to fly or just them be on standby. So I think, and as you got closer and closer to the extraction of this pilot, and General Kane talks about how you had to send in the A-10 Thunderbolt, or the Warthogs, as you call it, because they're an armed aircraft that can take a tremendous amount of punishment. And so you have A-10s, then you had, again, the drones or Reapers, Predators, whatever you want to call them, air refueling aircraft, plus helicopters. You had MC-130s, you had helicopters, because he was in the mountains, so a plane can't land, and you got to have people, the guys that are going to extract them, the pararescue men, so they got to come in on helicopters. So yeah, you start putting all that together in the timeline that it stretched out. I mean, you have tons of it. And then you had B-1 bombers. Again, you had the people looking for them. You had the military looking for them. Enemy, right? So they had to be ready to drop a tremendous amount of ordnance to save this guy and protect them and protect the personnel that were extracting this pilot. So yeah, you start looking at all those aircraft and man hours that took to get one person. And yeah, I can see how it piled up to those numbers.
So now who's coordinating all of that? Is the combat controller part of that orchestrating that operation, or who's basically in charge of it? Like every second, who would give orders, or how? Take us about behind the scenes logistics of it as much as you can. I'm sure a lot of it maybe is classified, but whatever you can tell us.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of stuff that's open source, right? But from when I was, for example, Afghanistan, I can speak to that. But you have a commander in charge of that area, right? And then they start the planning. So not only do you have the logistics of, okay, let's look at tankers and intelligence. You have intelligence cells that are looking at the imagery. They're studying where this pilot could be. Then they're receiving radio signals from his survival radio. So then you're piecing all that stuff together. And then you're putting in a package, the CSAR package, or the Combat Search and Rescue package, that extends from, okay, we're obviously going to go into a hostile force where now we don't really know who is good and who's bad, right? Because of this bounty on this pilot. So the on the normal level, and the way I train on combat search and rescue, you have two pararescuemen and a combat controller at the very least. And that's just in the training scenario where everything's safe, right? The reason why there's those three personnel, two, the pararescuemen go in, their primary job is to get the downed pilot, assess him, make sure he's okay, make sure they can transport him. And then what they're doing is their whole job is to stabilize this person. The combat controller is there, like I said earlier, to give that air-to-ground interface. So as the pararescuemen are giving the combat controller the information of his vitals, and they call it a nine-line format, the combat controller is relaying that up to the aircraft flying overhead. And the aircraft overhead are relaying it to either other transport aircraft or to the field hospital, whatever they're going to do with this down pilot. Now, in Iran, for example, in this particular mission, you have to have a combat controller because those three personnel at the very least are on the ground. So while the pararescuemen are treating this pilot, the combat controller is assessing the situation, talking to the aircraft, pushing the aircraft to patrol different sectors, make sure they don't get flanked, getting information from the aircraft, you know, telling them, hey, you got either bad guys moving in on you, or hey, this is a, you know, just giving them good situational awareness, right? Not only for the guys on the ground, but the guys on up in the air. So with this mission, because they were expecting to take contact, then you have, I'm sure you had, you know, there's reports of the SEALs being there, and I'm sure other joint operation operators were there. So they're building rings of protection around the down pilot. So you had to have a tremendous amount of movement, moving parts to protect them. So the coordination, to answer your question, I mean, it took a whole lot. Obviously, you have one general or one commander that's leading that operation, but once you're on the ground, I mean, it's truly up to that combat controller to orchestrate all that aircraft and in the mission for mission success. But you have those moving pieces of the support element of, you know, the SEALs or the Green Berets, whoever it may be, to protect them, to provide an outside cordon to get this pilot out. And then you have the rings of aircraft that's stacked overhead that are deconflicted by airspace altitude, and to protect those, what's going on the ground. And as you saw in open sources now, I mean, they had to destroy some of the aircraft because with, I read that it was sand that got into the engines, plus it was wet. So, and then they were taking fire. So as you can imagine, the chaos of, you know, everybody knew we were coming for this guy eventually, right? So, I could just imagine the amount of coordination and all the men and women that went into protecting the guys on the ground, but extracting this pilot.
Now, tell us a bit about the cooperation, how they work together, the special operation forces, the intelligence, and also the air assets. Especially the intelligence, who's in charge, or how does the intelligence give information to the special forces? How is that flow, that the information?
Yes, so since it was a joint operation, the intelligence cells could be Army, Navy. I mean, they're all there, right? Because, I mean, you had the strike group, you know, you had strike groups, you had the Army, you had the Navy and the Air Force. And so everybody has their own intelligence cells, but when we're doing operations like this, we all work together. You know, they have different expertise, if you will, and they're combining that package. Now, once these guys go out the door, whatever intelligence they have, that's pretty much what they have. Yes, you're still getting, you know, up-to-date information from what the pilots receive from the home base, if you will, and relaying it to the aircraft on the way, and then when you're on the ground doing your mission. So, yeah, I mean, the intelligence is a big part, and everybody just works together. And then when you're on the ground, like I was saying earlier, the combat controller is getting information from one aircraft. Let's just say it was the B-1 bomber that was overhead, because they have the highest stack, they're highest on the stack. So they're overwatching that whole thing, right? They call it a warden. So they're looking at this whole operation, and they're receiving information from the rear, sending it down to the ground. The guy on the ground, the combat controller, is sending information upward, and he's controlling the whole thing, and he's coordinating how they're going to extract, what aircraft are coming in, where they're taking fire from, and he's also directing fire. So if there were, what it sounds like, it was a pretty hot landing zone or LZ. Yeah. So not only is he relaying information about the patient, about where they're at, where they're taking fire from, he's calling in airstrikes, he's coordinating aircraft to come in on gun runs or bomb runs, or, you know, using the MH-6s, which are the little birds. So I'm sure they were getting their gun runs in there too. So it's, at the time, it's one person coordinating all that. So that's why combat controllers, you never really hear about them. But I mean, at the end of the day, the commander of that whole operation is in charge.
That's pretty amazing. Now, you got the Bronze Star twice, one of them with Valor for a four-hour firefight in Afghanistan. And given that experience, I kind of want to ask you, what do you think the pilot, those two officers in the plane, what do you think was going through their mind as they were ejecting after they landed, and you know, and then they start, you know, one of them hiked for hours, and it was, you know, what do you think went through their minds as all that process panned out?
Well, I think it's, you know, with this administration, I think they knew that we were going to come get them, right? I saw that the pilot had to climb at least 2,000 meters, yeah. Which is quite a bit, especially if you're injured. And, you know, people ejecting, I've never ejected from a plane, but just from what I've read and things that I knew, I mean, it's a tremendous blow to your body when you're going, God knows how fast they were going before they had to eject from an F-15, which is, you know, it's a tremendous aircraft. So I think what they were going, what they were thinking, especially like when I was on the ground, I knew that when we had aircraft overhead and you can hear the engines of an American aircraft, we called it the sound of freedom. You knew in your heart that you were going to be safe, you know, and they were going to, the guys above you were going to do everything they could to get you out of there. So I think the pilot, once, you know, his radio was starting to receive messages and he knew that he was going to get extracted, I think he was a little bit more at peace that they were going to come get him. And not only the ground guys that were going to come retrieve this pilot, I mean, pilots do all kinds of things that sometimes they sacrifice themselves and their aircraft to save the guys on the ground. So now it was our turn to go return the favor. So I think he knew that we were going to come get him, and then all his wingmen that were going to say, hey, we're not going to let this guy get captured by the Iranian populace or the enemy. So I'm sure he felt quite a bit at ease that there was no doubt we were going to get our guy.
So combat controllers are the ones that are first there, right? And how
that is our motto, yeah.
Yeah. How does that mindset translate into doing a seamless operation? What is the thing that's in your mind?
Yeah, so when to address the question, first there was our motto, because we're usually jumping in first, especially like example, Afghanistan, we jumped in first with Rangers in there because we had to open up airfields, and we have 30 minutes to open up an airfield because the remaining forces are coming in. So you're there, there's no quitting, and mission failure is not an option. So when we go, every time we get sent in there, our focus is to win, right? And to succeed. One of the models that I was on when I worked in England, in fact, when I worked with the F-15 squadron out of Lakenheath, which where these pilots were from, our team motto was burn the boats. And if you're familiar with burn the boats, I mean, there was just, we're there to win. There's no failure. So I think our mindset is so ready, and there's just no room for failure or even excuses. We just go, and a lot of us, you know, you look at John Chapman's story, he lost his life fighting to the very end to protect his teammates and making sure they got out. So yeah, it's no quitting and no failures in the way we're bred through this training program.
Well, so I got to ask you about the morale of the U.S. military. And of course, if we compare like to the morale of like China or North Korea military, they would probably defect if they had the chance to, right? But the morale of the U.S. military and what this extraction did to it, you know, it's been so publicized and it was so big. So can you talk to that? Like, what did it do to the military?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, it showed that the commander-in-chief, the secretary of war, and everybody, the politicians, especially from the Trump administration, are behind the men and women that are getting put out in harm's way. You know, it's, a lot of them sometimes talk about how they have our back, but they really don't, right? They restrict you in rules of engagement, and it makes it hard for the warfighter to fight a war when you have these restrictions. And I think with the Trump administration, you see totally different. We had a downed airman, and he said, hey, I don't care what it takes, go get our guy. And they did that. So morale is huge. And it just makes you want to join the military. It makes you want to go fight. And not only that, but I'm sure after they recovered and everything, as you said, it's been highly publicized, I'm sure young men and women that are saying, man, I want to serve my country because I may have the chance to do that, right? Either go fight or go rescue someone that's in need. So yeah, I mean, it's huge. And it also put the U.S. military on the map for, you know, everybody else to see, including our adversaries. So now they know, it's just like, okay, well, this new guy's in the White House, it's not playing any games anymore. So yeah, it's great show of American power.
Talking about that, tell us a bit about your story. Why did you join the military, and, well, you know, what your background? How did you end up in the military?
Well, I wish my background story was a little bit sexier, but I didn't want to join the military. I wanted to go to college, and I wanted to be a suit and tie businessman. And it just took me a lot longer to get there. But at the time, my parents couldn't really afford it, and I was having too much fun at Texas Tech University. And yeah, it was join the military, do 4 years, get a college degree. And so I went that route. I went to the Air Force when I was 20. And, you know, I enlisted, I was having a good time, and I loved the Air Force. I came in as a security forces, which is military police. And I didn't have my degree quite yet. And then I reenlisted, and 9/11 took place. And that just, it just enraged me. And I wanted to get some revenge. So I was going to get out, join the Army or maybe the Navy, because I wanted to go Special Forces. And luckily I met a combat controller, and he said, "Hey man, just become a combat controller. You have this great way of life here, and then you get to go and work with all those guys. But at the end of the day, you stay at a 5-star hotel and not stay in the tent." I'm just kidding about that, but it is better quality of life. And yeah, 2 years later, and I went through the program, and a year and a half later, I was in Afghanistan. So yeah, all my combat was in Afghanistan.
So 9/11 played a big role in your motivation to join or to...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, just seeing what happened in New York. And yeah, and I think a lot of people that I served with, especially combat controllers and SEALs, Green Berets, Raiders, when we all came together, we all wanted that payback, right? We joined because of what happened on our soil, and we wanted to get some revenge for especially the innocent people we lost in New York City. So yeah, that was definitely the key driver for me.
Tell us a bit about the camaraderie between the armed forces and the bond that exists between the people in the air, like yourself, and then the forces on the ground. Tell us about the trust and the bond of that connection.
Yeah, there's we like to poke fun at each other, right? I mean, that's just, I think it just happens. I mean, with siblings, and same thing in the armed forces. But when we go to war, I mean, we all wear the stars and stripes on our right shoulder, and we go up against whatever enemy standing in front of us. And for this, you know, ground to air piece, even the Navy, right? The Navy was heavily involved. We all go there to do a mission, and we look after each other because we're Americans and we're on foreign soil, and we're at war. We're fighting someone. So, yeah, it's there's a lot of love there, and there's a lot of trust, because you know that if there's Americans, if I was the pilot that was behind enemy lines, I knew in my bones that these guys were going to come get me, that no matter what happened, my body would come back to the U.S. alive or dead. But yeah, the love that we have for each other, it's we can pick on each other, that's between us, but if anybody tries to pick on us, then they're in for a big fight.
Well, Eric, I want to ask you about some of the stories you have, you know, from your career. And I know for one thing that you were in a group with Romanian military officers, and I am from Romania, so I want to hear that story first, and then any other thing that you want to talk about.
Absolutely. It was my first deployment, and we were doing a joint operation where we had part of a Army Special Forces team, an ODA, and we were teamed up with a Romanian ODA.
And what was ODA?
Obviously, Operational Detachment Alpha, Special Forces team.
Okay.
When I joined those two teams, I was the only Air Force guy. So they have never worked with an Air Force combat controller. And obviously it was my first time working with two different ODAs from two different countries, or American ODA and a Romanian ODA. But man, those guys were great. The Romanians took me in with open arms. We hung out, you know, they're the greatest people I've ever met. And in fact, I'm still friends with them to this day. They introduced me to probably some bad words and some of the things that they knew about Romania. They kept inviting me to come out after the deployment was over, but I haven't made it out there. But yeah, one of my bucket list items is just to go out there and meet up with some of those guys that I was in Afghanistan with. And like I said, they're a great bunch of guys, and they, when we go on patrol, I mean, they they took extra good care of me, right? Because they knew what my piece was to that team. If I were to get hurt or injured during a deployment, you know, a firefight or whatever it may be, we'd be behind the eight ball a little bit more. So I knew they took extra care of me to make sure that I was safe and sound. And the same for them. They knew that if they were injured or anything like that, that I had no problem making sure that our enemy would be decimated, and I wanted to make sure that they came home to their families, and to, you know, so yeah, it was a mutual respect, and I love them. They were amazing guys.
Yeah, there's an interesting picture with all of them wearing tuxedos, right? That I guess you got it for them. So
yeah, so I used to say it was I had a tuxedo T-shirt at the time, and you could see the bow tie underneath my kit, and I would say, hey, we're what was it? It's like party in the front, but business. I don't know. It was something like party and business mixed together. And they had never had one. So I was like, oh, I'm going to get you guys tuxedo T-shirts before this deployment's over. And I called my mom and I said, hey, can you get me a bunch of these tuxedo T-shirts? And she went and got them. And right before they left, I think a month before I did, they left country before I did. And we all took a tuxedo T-shirt picture with our berets on. And yeah, man, it was a great memento, and I still have that picture, and I shared it with you guys because it was just awesome to have a little fun while you're in some of the worst conditions on this planet.
Well, tell us about the teddy bear story.
So it was my second deployment, and I was with a team out of Japan, an American ODA, and we were the furthest team in the south, and it was miserable. I mean, you want to know a little about war. So we took over a compound, an Afghani compound. There was obviously no running water. Everything's dusty. It's super hot. It's just miserable. I mean, I don't know. I used to say, why can't we fight somewhere nice? We always fight in these terrible crap holes, right? And so it was, Halloween was coming up during this deployment. And I said to my Army team sergeant, I said, hey, we should dress up like the Messiah and wear togas and wear our body armor underneath. And then when we get in a fight, then, you know, we just rip the togas off and we start engaging the enemy. So obviously he thought I was an idiot. He said no. So for whatever reason, I got mad and I went into my hooch, my sleeping area, and I hopped on the internet, and the movie Ted had just been out. So I found a Ted costume, and I ordered one, and you have an APO address when you're deployed, right?
Yeah.
So I emailed the company and said, hey, this is who I am. I'm a combat controller. I'm deployed. I would really like to have this as soon as possible because it's going to take forever to get here. And I received an email fairly quickly, and the guy said, hey, I'm the CEO. I'm putting this in the mail for you right now. Thank you for what you do. You know, here you go. So 2 weeks later or so, I forgot that I had ordered it. And on my fire base, I was in charge of bringing in resupply. So a helicopter, a CH-47, you know, the twin rotor one, mm-hmm. is landing. And my call sign was Jaguar. He's like, hey, Jaguar, are you available? And I said, yeah, what's up? So the crew chief comes out with his box and he goes, hey, this is for you. This is from your commander, you know, your team down in Bagram. So I said, oh, okay. And I thought it was usually batteries or, you know, whatever I needed. So I take off the helicopter and I go into my hooch and I open it. And the first thing I see is this giant teddy bear face. And I started laughing. I was like, oh, my Ted suit. So I take off my body armor, I put it on, and I walk out with it in full teddy bear outfit. And it was such an instant morale for my, you know, I was with an ODA and a couple of infantry guys and infantry squad. So I think it was a total of, I think we had a total of like 28 guys on this compound. And man, it was just morale, right? Guys were coming out, we were taking pictures, guys were smoking, you know, their cigarettes while I was shaking their hands. And then word got out. So we had Apaches, the Apache helicopters that would patrol this particular section. And they knew we were the furthest team in the south, and they knew that they needed to check on us quite a bit. So because that story got out, then they would call me and say, hey man, can you put on that teddy bear suit? We want to get you on our targeting pod. So I would put it on and go out there and wave at them. And yeah, I mean, it was morale for them too, right? To watch this giant teddy bear with body armor. And then for our enemy, our enemy didn't wear uniform. They, you know, they're just regular people. And then when they wanted to, they'd shoot at us. And then when they wanted something from us, they'd come and ask. So I would hide behind this this wall on the second floor, and as they would walk by our compound, because they were just gathering intelligence on what we were doing, I would slowly creep my head up over the wall and wave at them and then point my weapon at these people. And, you know, they would freak out because obviously they've never seen a ginormous teddy bear. And I don't know, I used to think it was pretty funny. And
I think
so did the guys.
You need those moments for sure. And I'm sure how they would really bring...
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, you know, like I said, there was no running water. You had to take a shower with, you know, pallets of water. You know, if you had to go to the bathroom, I mean, it was just, yeah, I'm a creature of comfort these days because of my time at war. I just refuse to be uncomfortable now.
Now, I got to move on and ask you about what happens with military personnel after they transition to civilian life. There's always a difficult transition, or not always, but often. And I can't help but thinking about the movie Rambo, the first one, when, you know, he's probably the best, one of the best special forces. He comes back and then, you know, how it just really shows the lack of respect for the veterans and how difficult it has been for him to readjust. It's a movie, of course, but, you know, I think that happens a lot. So can you talk about that? And you also have a nonprofit that you are working with.
Yeah. So there was... you're right. You know, in that movie, just reminded me, he keeps saying he just wants peace, right? He's just traveling. And he's just like, man, I just want some peace. Leave me alone. But because he has long hair, he looks weird. They harass him and, you know, the rest of the movie.
Yes.
But I think for a lot of us, when we get out, especially for me, I got out and I didn't do 20. I did 15. And I thought, I'm going to take the world by storm. I'm an operator. I have a business degree now. I'm working on my MBA. Who wouldn't want to hire me? And then as you leave the military, especially those small teams, you realize the corporate world and civilian world is very tough. And I give you guys a lot of credit because in the military, when you join, everything's laid out for you. The time you got to get up, the time you go to sleep, what you got to wear, how your haircut looks, blah, 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 blah. Your life is your promotions. Everything's laid out for 20 years if you want, even longer.
Mm.
But when you leave that, you're in free fall. It's up to you.
Right.
And even though we have great discipline and great skills, it's just a different animal.
Yeah.
So when you get out, you lose the camaraderie. There's really no trust. You really can't talk about the stuff because your sense of humor is different. The way the speed of life that you were used to is so much different in the civilian world. I think it's slower, but it's so much different. And, you know, for me, I think in the friends that I've had that left, it's that, right? You're kind of a fish out of water and you're trying to figure it out. And then now when you're in the military, especially in those high level teams, the mission comes first. It's the mission above all else. So if you are getting divorced, if you're going through whatever you're going through, a death in the family, it doesn't matter, especially in those teams, mission comes first. You suppress your feelings, you go do the mission because that's, like I said before, there's no quitting and there's no failure. So eventually as you get out, you know, all that stuff catches up with you, no matter how good you're trained, it catches up. And that's why a lot of veterans sometimes do hit the bottle quite a bit. And then when you go to the VA, when they assess you, what's the VA say? It's here's some pills, right? Here's some pills for your depression. Here's some pills for this. Here's some pills for that. Your aches and pains, get out of here. We'll see you in a year. So now you mix pharmaceuticals with alcohol and God knows what else you're into. Then you have this snowball effect of chaos. And yeah, I mean, I'm not bagging on the VA. They have a tough job. I mean, especially after the Afghanistan thing. I mean, that's 22 years of fighting where you had all these servicemen and women coming out. But yeah, it's very tough. For me, I experienced severe survivor's guilt, which was very tough. And then depression set in, which I didn't even realize what depression was till it's right in front of you and you just can't figure out what's wrong. And you know, a lot of praying, a good family network, some friends, but I went through it. You know, I hid in the bottle, pills for sleep medicine, depression medicine, nightmare medicine. I mean, I had a box full of this stuff, and something about it, I just knew that it wasn't for me. And probably a few years later, a good friend of mine who was my first teammate, he retired to 20 years, highly decorated, Purple Heart, survived some tremendous firefights. 6 months later, he puts a gun to his head and kills himself, or a gun to his chest, I should say. And it obviously broke our hearts. And then, you know, 3 months later, I had another teammate of mine that served with him, with Chris Rush, and he was going to do the same thing. So that's when I woke up and I said, okay, there's got to be something for us, for combat controllers, right? Because there's plenty of veteran organizations to take care of the veterans and their families, and they do a great job, but they're only treating the mind and the body. And for me, my soul was broken. And so I founded the first DARE Foundation, and then our flagship program is Operation Soul Rescue, which focuses in on the soul and repairing that, how to become whole. So yeah, it's a very tough process for a lot of men and women that leave the service.
Would you say one of the reasons is also the fact that the military is so well organized and civilian life, it's more chaotic in so many ways. It's very loose. You don't really have to answer to anyone. You can do whatever you want. And also the intensity level, like even for us in media or whatever we do, when you do something very intense, you get used to that pace. And then if you stop that, you feel like, hey, I gotta do something. You know, I can, you know, I'll go crazy if I don't have that level of intensity.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, because you figure when we're even in Afghanistan, I mean, you're deployed for 6 months at a time. So even though you feel like your body's normal, you say, okay, I'm going to get up, drink coffee, look at the operations board, and then I'm going to go go on patrol and get in this fight. Your body's in a constant fight or flight because you're in Afghanistan. You're in the middle of, we're in a compound full of three villages that want to kill us, right? And it's just not normal for the human body to do that. So then you come home and all of a sudden everything's moving at such a slow pace. Yeah, I mean, your body's going crazy of like, what do I do now? So I could imagine you guys in the media, when if you're embedded with a unit, or you're covering news that's just happening constantly. I mean, you're on the go, right? You're barely eating. You're surviving on a few hours sleep, and you're just going and going and going. And it feels good because there's purpose, there's movement there. But then when you come back home and now the news story is a cat is stuck in a tree or whatever it is, then it makes you mad because you just need humans. In my opinion, you need purpose, especially the way we're made, right? Especially once you've tasted that tempo. So yeah, I agree with you. It's a big shock to the system.
So we talked about the administration, and can you tell us a little bit about the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth? How do military people view him? He's obviously, you know, he's been in the military himself. He's talking about being in shape and all of these kind of tough things. You know, he's controversial in many ways, but what are your thoughts about it?
I think it's good for morale, and I think it's great that you have a guy that served, was deployed, and was with the troops. And I think he definitely shows that in when he goes out to visit. He's out there with them. He's doing PT, shaking their hands, because he lived it, right? He's not a politician that's just saying, well, I'm the Secretary of War now, and you guys go fight, and I have your back. He's actually lived it. He knows the stress that it causes on the family. He knows the stress that it causes for some younger people that it might be their first deployment, that are their first time leaving home, and now they're getting sent to Iran, right? Or they're in a major battle with a major country. So I think it adds that backing and that support for a lot of men and women. And he is going to go to bat against some of these other, for example, left politicians, that some of them, which I can believe that they were saying, how could we waste so much resources and time and energy to recover one American pilot, which if it was their son or their husband, they would say, do whatever you need to do to bring that person back. But because they hate President Trump so much, and not to get too political, but they hate a man so much that they would rather see an American pilot get captured or killed. And I think with Pete at the helm, being the Department of War, he's good for the troops and he's good for that department. His speeches are kind of funny, the way he talks, and it kind of makes me laugh watching his press conferences. I think he tries to be a little bit too dramatic, but hey, that's just him. But as far as morale, I think he's a good guy.
Well, I think it seems pretty obvious that the morale of the entire U.S. military has been boosted so much by this rescue. And yeah, you can think of just one person, one military, but it just gives a lot of support to everyone else. Now, in conclusion, can you please tell us a bit about your foundation more? What are your goals? What are you doing with it, and what's next for you?
Sure. So as I alluded to earlier, there's a lot of great organizations that treat veterans, right? They do what they can, treat the mind and body, which is good. But I think to me, if your soul's broken, that's what you need to be repairing. And I pride myself, I say that we're an unconventional nonprofit for unconventional people. And the thing is that for us, I didn't want to be an organization that puts on fundraisers and you have these donors that give money and then you take the guy, the men or women, skiing or deep sea fishing or whatever it is, right? Because what happens is, and I went through one of those trips, I'm not knocking them, but what happens is it's instant gratification for the donor, for that organization. So you take this person, let's just say skiing in Aspen or something, they stay at the Ritz-Carlton or a great hotel for a week, picture ops, clicks go up, social media, blah, blah, blah. But then when they come home, they come back to their job or to their small apartment, and now they're depression. They're falling deeper and deeper into this depression because they've tasted a life that's probably not going to happen anytime soon anyways. So you're not really helping these guys. So what my nonprofit does, when I say treating the soul, is Operation Soul Rescue. I found plant medicine, and plant medicine has been controversial, but I can tell you that I grew up Catholic, so I'm a Christian, and it didn't replace my faith. It brought me closer to God. And it's made me whole enough where with plant medicine, it's very sacred. It's something that's been around for centuries. And like any other medicine, I mean, obviously you hear of people abusing it. Well, I mean, you can abuse Tylenol and have the same effects, right? And then you have alcohol, which is the one poison that is, for whatever reason, it's normal. But with plant medicine, it's done right. We have the right protocols where we've treated people that were suicidal. They were just ready to check out. And after a weekend, it's changed their lives. And now we've had, celebrities come out, like Aaron Rodgers, who plays for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And before he played with the Green Bay Packers, and he said, hey, this changed my life. So if it's making someone whole and to love again and to feel great, how is this bad? Now, plant medicine is it's not bad on your organs. It helps reestablish your neurons, your brain plasticity. It just helps your brain fire. Now, you take a pharmaceutical, and I'm not against the West medicine at all, right? I think the body's so complex that you have to have a little bit of everything, right? Whether it's Western medicine, Eastern medicine, plant medicine, whatever it is, we're so complex that whatever's going to make this person whole. But you taking, for example, when I first got out, antidepressants that you establish a baseline, then you get used to them. And then you got to go back in a year and take more and more and more. And I was a walking zombie. And I think that's why some people are still so depressed and so miserable. And with plant medicine, it just helps you see what you've been carrying, the trauma you've carried. And it allows you to take some active participation in your healing. And what we do is, we put these people through Operation Soul Rescue, and we have a great network. We have a great board. And obviously we need donations. And I mean, I'm telling you, it's life-changing. And if you would have told me 5 years ago that I was going to be running a nonprofit, especially with plant medicine, I would have said, no, you're crazy, because I grew up Catholic. But again, God works in mysterious ways. And I'll leave that to your viewers or whoever's listening. It's, sometimes I get that stink eye from people saying like, oh, you're sinning. Well, how could I be sinning if it's brought me closer to God? And now my faith is stronger than ever. And it's good for my body, right? And I don't abuse it. I take it, and the people that I love are better for it. They're better dads, they're better wives. It's an amazing medicine, and it's got to be respected, and it's got to be sacred, and there's protocols for it. But like I said, just like anything else, when you can abuse whatever, and it goes out by the wayside. And I think the reason why it gets a bad rep is because it is cheap and it is easy to help people recover. So obviously that hurts the people invested in pharmaceuticals. So that's not a good thing for them.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your service, and thank you for all the work you're doing and for sharing with us your stories. I appreciate it.
It was my honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for watching another episode of Bay Area Innovators. If you enjoyed this episode and you know someone who should be on our show, please send us an email at sfbay@epochtimes.com. We would love to hear from you. Thank you, and see you next week.